today. The arrest of its alleged godfather figure has dealt a massive blow to the Sicilian mafia. Is it game over? Plus, Jonathan Watts on what we learned from the COP24 climate talks. Earlier this month, in a dawn raid in Sicily, Italian police arrested 46 members of Cosa Nostra, the island's notorious mafia. Taken out in handcuffs was the man alleged to be the new godfather figure, an 80-year-old jeweller named Settimo Mineo. Investigators say he was recently elected the head of the Sicilian mafia's governing body, known as the Commission. It's the third time the mafia has tried and failed to regroup after the arrest of its most influential boss of bosses, Toto Riina. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in focus, is this the end for the Sicilian mafia?
The police have been waiting to pounce. They knew that a whole raft of mafia bosses were about to get out of prison, and so they've been watching them like hawks.
The Guardian's Claire Longrig is one of the country's leading experts on the mafia.
They've been running surveillance, bugging cars and meeting rooms, and when they got news that there'd been a meeting of the commission, they followed closely what had been discussed, and after the meeting, one of the bosses was chatting about it in his car with his driver, and the police had managed to get a bug somehow into the car. So the boss was talking about who was there, naming names. You can imagine he's kicking himself now. You could see this vision of them, rebuilding, getting the band back together, you know, rebuilding this beautiful commission that had been so decimated.
So this is the third time the Sicilian mafia has tried to re-establish this kind of committee of bosses called the Commission since the arrest of a previous godfather figure called Toto Riina. It sounds like, to understand why that is, we need to understand him. So who is he?
Toto Riina, known as the Beast, but also known as Shorty Ucurta.
And known by who?
Nobody to his face, I imagine. Was the tyrant of Cosa Nostra. He ruled with an absolute iron rod he was a mass murderer.
Guarda che uno una volta che ci va accompagnato non può sapere i posti, ma uno che va da solo una volta.
Toto Riina was born in Corleone, this tiny little farming town in the center of Sicily, and he was brought up by the previous boss Luciano Ligio as his kind of young upstart. Riina and his sidekick, Bernardo Provenzano, were young and aggressive and very daring. In the 80s, there was a massive war in the Sicilian mafia, really for the control of the drug trade. So there was a tremendous amount of bloodletting. There were people being killed in the street, high-level, judges and magistrates and police gunned down in the streets of Palermo and Monreale. Mafiosi found dead in their cars. It was a state of war. In old times, I think the mafia bosses would have discussed if there was a problem, they'd have got together, they'd have resolved it. But Riina would just go in and kill everybody. It was his way of dealing with his enemies. It was not to do deals with them or to have any kind of diplomatic solutions, but just to murder them.
Okay, Toto Riina has consolidated power and taken the mafia in a much more murderous and violent direction, which results in a massive backlash from the Italian authorities.
In the early 80s, an anti-mafia judge called Giovanni Falcone started a huge investigation. Falcone went after the money, so he chased down all the profits from drug dealing that were running between Sicily and America and proved that the mafia was a massive international business. Before, these old guys in their little cloth caps had always sat on the stand in court and said, I don't know what you're talking about. Mafia doesn't exist. It's just a word. It's just air. And there had never been any way of proving that these old guys were responsible for international conspiracy and huge drug dealing criminal enterprises. So Falcone had found where the money was coming from. And between those two factors, the Maxi trial was born, which brought over 400 mobsters to court for the first time in history.
And Falcone worked alongside another prosecutor called Paolo Borsellino. What were they like?
Paolo Borsellino was, by all accounts, a very gentle person, very, very kind. He managed to persuade a number of women to speak out against the mafia. And they found him sort of like a father figure. Giovanni Falcone was extremely clever and courageous and managed, because he treated people with respect. He treated the mob bosses that he dealt with respect. They respected him too.
So we have this double act, scrupulously investigating the Sicilian mafia, closing in on their targets. And then in 1986, prosecutors indicted 475 mob figures, including Toto Riina. Most of them were placed on trial, but Riina was already in hiding and was tried in absentia. Tell us about the Maxi trial.
The trial itself was absolutely explosive.
The largest trial in Italian history began today in a Palermo, Sicily courtroom. It had all the makings of a major motion picture.
Tommaso Buscetta, this mythological mafia boss, took the stand and was filmed.
Signor Presidente, volevo comunicarle che l'imputato Tommaso Buscetta, che
ho talking about for the first time ever, the commission, men of honor. He introduced himself as a man of honor. This had never been done in public before. And he identified the mob bosses who were standing the defendants behind these bars, like in cages. It was incredibly intimidating sort of atmosphere. And Buscetta and the other supergrasses gave evidence from inside a kind of clear bulletproof box. And, you know, there were six or seven armed guards for each supergrass, ducked themselves in a sort of godfatherly manner. So Luciano Ligio comes in. You could see him putting his hands through the bars, and he's smoking a cigar, and he's wearing his sunglasses. They had these extraordinary encounters. They had dialogues in court, which I've never seen in any other situation, where he would confront other mafia bosses. And Buscetta's family had been systematically murdered once he started talking to the authorities, and he got to confront one of the authors of these murders in court. So it's incredibly dramatic.
Why did Buscetta testify? Wasn't he terrified?
Buscetta's reason for testifying against the mafia was that he felt that the mafia had become degraded, that these Corleone upstarts had ruined everything, that they broke the rules, they were trampling over all the old distinctions and the old codes of honor, and that he no longer recognized this organization as the, you know, the hallowed Cosa Nostra that he'd given his entire life and career to.
Most of the defendants were convicted, including Riina, but he was still on the run.
The mafia expected these guilty verdicts to go to appeal and be overturned, and everybody be out by Christmas, as had always been the case before, because there were numerous corrupt judges, particularly in the appeals court. There was one called, whose nickname was Sentence Killer, Ammazza Sentenza. And they would just overturn the sentences and everybody would go home.
And that didn't happen this time.
So this time, the Maxi trial sentences were upheld in 1992 and everybody stayed in prison. And it was the most shocking thing for the mafia. For Cosa Nostra, it was devastating. This had never happened before. And this triggered in Riina this great revenge, this desire for to destroy the state. He actually declared war on the state at that time. He started a bombing campaign on the mainland. The bombs went off in Rome, in the Church of San Giovanni Laterano, places where tourists go, in Florence, and he signed a death warrant for judges Falcone and Borsellino.
So what happened next?
Judge Falcone was murdered in May 1992 with his wife and members of his police escort. They were blown up in a massive bomb on the motorway between the airport and Palermo. It was an absolutely devastating scene.
Sono le prime drammatiche immagini che ci giungono da Palermo e che ci danno la misura della violenza dell'esplosione. Le macchine
and
sono
then
state
a couple of months later, his great working partner and soulmate Paolo Borsellino was also murdered.
Were you there at the time?
I went to Palermo shortly after Judge Falcone was murdered, and there was the most extraordinary atmosphere. It was a kind of sudden outbreak of rage and grief against the mafia, this system that had always held the city, or really for years had held the city completely in thrall. And people had just were just saying, that's enough, it stops now. And there was a protest movement of people writing slogans on sheets and holding, flying them outside their apartment windows. There were hunger strikes, there were processions. The army was brought in to patrol the streets. It was the most extraordinary feeling. It was an incredibly sad moment, but at the same time, there was a real sense of finality, that the mafia had gone too far, and then that there was a civil uprising against it.
So it sounds like this was a really significant turning point. How did they finally catch Toto Riina?
Riina was arrested because his driver had been persuaded to give him up. And he was approached in the traffic in Palermo and stopped. And it was a huge moment. It was a huge moment for the anti-mafia movement. I remember tremendous celebrations. It was really the end of an era.
So clearly this was a significant point in 1993. Toto Riina had been arrested, put in prison. Did he give up in there?
There's a very high security system for mafiosi in Italian prisons. So they are under surveillance at all times and they're in solitary confinement. But there are videos and audio of him trying to get messages to the outside world. So when he was in court, he had this interesting sort of system of hand signals that he would use to communicate with his lawyers or with any family members who were there. And of course, you know, journalists and judges desperately trying to figure out what he was saying. There was another time when he was in an exercise yard in prison, and he sort of used a newspaper to try and cover his head so that the cameras wouldn't pick up what he was talking, what he was saying to somebody. They wouldn't be able to lip read. So he was giving commands, it turns out, from inside jail for all those years that he was in prison. He was still the de facto leader of Cosa Nostra while he was in prison.
So Riina's in jail, but his reign had devastated the Sicilian mafia. Law enforcement were cracking down on anyone left outside prison. A new leader began to gradually rebuild the Cosa Nostra, but with a much lower profile. When did Riina die?
Riina died just over a year ago, November 2017. And so it was a moment when there was going to be a regrouping and an heir to his throne had to be appointed. The only way the governing commission of Cosa Nostra was really going to be able to pull itself together and return to Palermo, which was its heartland, so cutting off the legacy of Riina, would be to get together just the senior bosses and reinstitute a kind of decision-making quorum. whereby the old hierarchy and the old structures could be reimposed.
Finally, after decades, the families of the Sicilian Mafia met together in May. Investigators say they appointed a replacement for Rina, Settimo Maneo. But the decision to meet brought trouble to the group because the authorities were listening in.
There was a very dramatic dawn raid. The Sicilian police are very good at these, you know, helicopters, and you know, they have to do massive swoop all at the same time before dawn. And yes, 46 men dragged out of their beds.
An unprecedented and extraordinary result to fight one of the most powerful criminal organization in the world.
But what now, after all these arrests? Is the Mafia dead?
It is a major deal that all of these bosses have been picked up, and this latest attempt to reform the commission and restart Cosa Nostra's fortunes has failed. But at the same time, Mafia business still goes on. They still have massive protection rackets going on in the neighbourhoods. Neighbourhood businesses have to pay protection money. They are running businesses like trash collection and disposal, online gambling, drug trafficking still goes on. Rina's tyrannical behaviour and his out-of-control war against the state really nearly brought the Cosa Nostra to its end. He went too far for his own people, he went too far for the population to withstand, and he brought the police and the judiciary down very hard against the organisation. And he pulled apart all the old bonds and hierarchies and destroyed the relationships between families, that it's made it very difficult for it to come back together.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, are we on track to reverse climate change? Welcome back. This month, politicians, scientists and UN delegates from across the world met in Poland to establish the rules for putting the 2015 Paris Agreement on climate change into action. The conference, COP24, lasted 2 weeks and resulted in heated clashes between individuals and countries. Jonathan Watts, The Guardian's global environment editor, was there.
Well, the science is saying all the lights are flashing red right now. And just 2 months ago, of course, we had a new scientific report by the world's top scientists that showed that even the difference from 1.5 degrees Celsius warming to 2 degrees Celsius warming, in other words, half a degree difference, would make an enormous change to natural systems. The Arctic shelf would be lost. All the world's coral reefs would go, and hundreds of millions more people would be affected. In other words, science is telling us we've really got to get a move on. It's super urgent. And the UN process works in this painstaking way, but it's the only way they know how to do it, to get consensus of more than 190 countries. The aim of this summit was to try to draw up a rule book for basically the hardest thing humanity has ever tried to do. So, big ask. It's mega bureaucracy. It's infuriating bureaucracy. More than 10,000 people gathered together in a conference room, all trying to thrash out this new rule book so that all the countries are playing by the same rules when they agree to cut emissions. The key points we should take away from this climate summit is, first of all, that the world nudged forward. There was agreement on a new rule book on how we monitor and verify emissions. There was also some agreement on financing. Where we had problems were that, first of all, it wasn't fast enough. All the scientists are saying we've got to be moving forward so much more quickly. There are clear divisions apparent at the talks, and the biggest of the divisions this time was the alliance of interests of the three biggest fossil fuel producers, the US, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, who were all very reluctant to accept the findings of the UN scientists. And they came together to kind of water it down. And this led to a very angry two-hour exchange in the plenary, which is usually very diplomatic and calm. What we don't know yet is whether this was a one-off or whether we might see more of this kind of this fossil fuel alliance trying to hold everything up. And then you had the hosts, Poland, very much the biggest coal economy of Europe. The Polish president opened climate talks by saying, "Ah, by the way, we have 200 years of coal and we don't plan to waste any of it." That was the opening speech. Equally mind-boggling was the fact that in the climate centre, every country has a sort of a base where it can show what it's doing. And the Polish display included blocks of coal and coal earrings and coal soap. The message was pretty clear that we're not going to do everything you want us to do. I mean, I'm laughing just because it's so horrendous. It's beyond the pale. But it's not just Poland. I mean, they were the hosts, so they were under the spotlight. But Australia has been incredibly disruptive towards sort of climate change recently, and that's largely because of its huge coal interests. Japan is moving more towards coal. Indonesia's developing a lot of coal-fired power plants. And of course, China is the world's biggest coal user and is struggling to move away from coal. On the question of what are the deadlines moving forward, well, next year has to be the year when we start to see real progress on ambition. Then the absolute key moment is 2020. And that's when there's going to be a super COP, a super climate conference, when the whole world will get together and say, this is going to be our new target, this is our new roadmap, and this is what we're going to do. I think this is the year when a lot of people really started to take climate change seriously because they felt it. The last 4 years have been the hottest 4 years ever seen. And now next year has to be the year when we do something about it. We've been talking about it for so long. There are individual things you can do. You can eat less red meat, you can fly less. But essentially what it all comes down to is the need for political action, collective action. But this is really the year to push governments in any way you can. Newspaper stories to protesting on the streets, because we're distracted by Trump, we're distracted by Brexit, we're distracted by a million other things that are, in the bigger picture, really not half as important as this.
That's it for today. My thanks to Claire Longrigg and Jonathan Watts. Today's producers were Josh Kelly, Rachel Humphreys and India Rackerson. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executives were Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.